Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Laser Graves, a podcast about the 1980s. Well, things that happened in the 1980s. I am your co-host, E.K. Wimmer.
Hello, E.K. Wimmer. I am Mariah Rose.
And we are in the middle of our holiday episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Last week we did elves.
Oh, boy. That was a fun one.
That was a good one. I enjoyed that.
I loved it. I kind of want to go back in time and just cover elves a few more times now and Christmas.
You ever have that experience where you watch a movie for the first time and then you're sad because you can never rewatch it for the first time?
Well, I have such a bad memory with the movies, so give me 10 years and it'll be a whole new time.
It's interesting that you have such a bad memory with movies, but an insane memory with everything else. Yeah. And I have an insane memory with movies and a bad memory with everything else.
We're like Voltron, though, together, superpowers.
That's right.
I will remember every dog's name that I ever meet, and I will forget movies.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're doing holiday episodes, and this week we're coming at it from a different angle.
I feel like that's the wise choice because you can't live up to elves, plural.
It's true. Not at all.
You gotta just steer the ship in a totally different direction.
Yeah, this week we're not doing cheesy horror. We're actually doing kind of iconic cult film, considered by most to be one of the greatest films ever made.
Whoa, calm down.
No, it's almost in every single top 100 to top 50 film on every list. We were talking about the one and only Brazil from 1985, directed by Terry Gilliam of Monty Python fame. And this is quite an interesting film, but it does take place on Christmas.
Yeah, and it also came out December 18th.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Oh.
So it's almost, I think it's 24 years later, or 34 years later.
Could you imagine this being your heartfelt Christmas movie you want to take your date to? Holy cow.
Yeah, it's not very Christmassy.
No, it's not very uplifting either.
Although if you are a movie person and you're taking a date to see a movie, this is a quick way to weed out the riffraff.
That's true. Before we hop in, let's talk about some thrift store finds. Okay. What do you got for me?
Okay, well, I had to do an 11th hour thrift store sweep since I was so busy all week.
Oh, those are always your best ones. What did you get?
Well, first I found a pair of earrings that honestly look like something straight out of Pee-wee's Playhouse. They are red circles or red triangles with a cow print and weird bent metal dangles. I'll put it on our Instagram feed so you can figure out what's what, but I love them. And then my other one was these cool mod hors d'oeuvre skewers.
Right.
So now I have to start making hors d'oeuvres, but other than that, I was very jazzed about them.
You just need a little motivation, and cool skewers will make you want to make hors d'oeuvres.
You pronounce skewers strangely, but also you say skewers. Say
no, that's what you just said.
Skewers.
We'll let our listeners be the judge.
Anyway, now I feel like I have to have a party because I have neat skewers.
Oh, man, you said that really weird.
Now I can't make any sense of that word. So don't say it.
Okay.
What about you? What are your thrift store finds?
I found a Christopher Pike book, The Last Vampire. We have, I think, pretty dang close to every single book he's made.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a few that we're missing. And I thought I didn't have this one, actually, but I did.
I was wondering that, too,
yeah.
Later.
But I had a really faded, beat-up version, so this was a real nice one.
Better.
So swapped it out.
Upswing.
And then I also found a VHS Ed Wood's Jailbait. Really sad that Ed Wood's films weren't in the 80s.
Oh, I know. I don't know, actually.
I guess that's why we got Jim Wynorski, basically. That's the 80s version of Ed Wood.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a compliment or an insult to Wynorski, but
it's a compliment, okay. For sure.
Would he take it that way is really the question.
Sure.
Okay.
I'm going to speak for him. Say
okay.
Sure.
Okay, you know him.
Okay, well, those were some interesting finds, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Weren't they, though?
Brazil. This is not a lighthearted, goofy film to crack jokes about. This is a really awesome, interesting commentary on so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
Bureaucracy, you know, kind of fascism, all this kind of strange things that take place in a distant post-apocalyptic future almost, but it's not post-apocalyptic. No. It's just kind of this regime. It's like 1984. It's very...
Yeah, Orwellian.
Yeah, very much so. But when did you first see Brazil?
I was in high school, but you know, I knew it was cool when I first saw it, but I think that a lot of it was over my head the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
And little things that didn't make sense, that just can't make sense until you experience life a little bit longer. So I think I've seen it one other time between age maybe 16 and now.
Oh, yeah.
So I think this is my third time seeing it. What about you?
Not too far off that. I saw it in high school also, and I really thought it was cool and the same. It was totally over my head. I thought it was cool because it's filmed really cool.
It's very visually interesting.
Very visually stunning. Yeah, it's got these awesome set designs.
Mm-hmm.
But all the commentary was over my head because I wasn't working for the man at the time, so I couldn't relate,
yeah.
You know. And now, like, in my older age, I definitely can relate to this kind of daydreaming because you're living this monotony, you know, or this monotonous life.
Yeah. And I think also there's several times in this where you feel the pure rage of just trying to file paperwork correctly.
Oh, yeah.
The, like, it's like a, you go to a threat level 11. You're going to explode if somebody doesn't just take these papers out of your possession. For whatever reason, you're filing taxes, you just have a form to return. That's something that you can't get as a teenager. You've never understood the urgent rage that you feel when you just want to turn the dumb paper in. You already filled it out.
And then you realize you've been sitting in that line for like 45 minutes and they tell you you forgot something at home and you have to go back and get it. Yes, I've also worked for the state, and boy, there was a lot of red tape in that position, too.
It was like a DMV. It's like a dystopian DMV nightmare.
It is. It's just a lot of hoops to jump through, and this film does a good job on not only pointing out just the frustrations of, like, steps you have to take to make sure everything's by the book, but also how slow everything can be, how uninformed everybody is in their positions, but they have these positions of power.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just very fascinating all around this very tragic story of this guy who just daydreams because he's got this kind of meaningless life otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fascinating. Like we said earlier, visually, it's just stunning.
Yes. You know, I was reading up on this earlier, and somebody kept saying about how Gilliam had this, like, unrelenting, beautiful imagination. And I think that we all have this imagination, but what's Gilliam's gift is not so much that he has an imagination, but he's able to give voice to that imagination and really see it through from all angles in a way that I think most directors are unable to do. The scope of his vision is so vast and his control over that vision.
Yeah, I agree. He is definitely like a full-fledged artist with a vision. And this is part of what was known as the trilogy. I think it was called like the Trilogy of Imagination or something like that. I know Time Bandits came before it. We have that. We should definitely...
We've seen it before, but it's been a long time,
yeah,
right?
No, we should do that one for sure. I actually have a really awesome... very first release of that on VHS. It's really cool. It's got the like booklet slip so that you open it up and then you have to slide it out within that kind of book form. It's beautiful, but we should watch that one too. But yeah, and interesting about that, you know, this is well documented for people who know this film, and I'm sure a lot of you listening have watched this film or know about it, but there's a very famous legal battle that happened with this film. And it all centers around Terry's vision of what he felt should have been seen versus what the studio thought should be seen. Did you read up on that at all?
Not really. So please elaborate.
Okay. So, and it'll be particularly of interest once we get to the end.
Okay.
But really what happened was he had this long drawn out version, which is the one that we've seen. And it does not end well.
Oh, so they wanted a happy ending.
They wanted a happy ending. And so I think it was Universal maybe that he was with. I could be wrong. But they wanted it cut a different way, and he didn't want it. And they ended up doing it kind of behind his back and cutting it to be more optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really upset because that's not the way the film was supposed to end. And so then it got in this huge legal battle where they were like trying to buy the rights back to the film and get it re-released through a different company so that it could be restored. And then they, you know, the other production company was threatening to just not release it at all because it was just, it was becoming a legal headache, like a total mm-hmm. nightmare. And what ended up happening was Terry ended up showing it in like film schools and private screenings and just started showing his version to people.
Okay.
Like behind the back of.
Oh, like trying to get some buzz.
Yeah. And it worked. It worked big time. And he was awarded some big award about it being like, I don't know, in LA something. I should have probably wrote it down, but I didn't care that much. But it was like the best film of the year, basically. And when that happened, the producers or the distribution company had no, they couldn't do anything but release the film in the way he had originally planned it because now the buzz was out.
So he painted them into a corner.
Yeah, because the people and the critics that had seen it were like, this is seriously the best film of the year, if not one of the best films we've ever seen.
Wow.
So they couldn't compromise after that. And he ended up getting it released the way he wanted.
I see it, though, because as a studio, you sink a lot of money into a movie. And the audience, especially in America, really want, like, they demand a happy ending. People are upset at, you know, things that don't have a nice bow at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
and this
tie
does
it up.
Not
no,
at all.
It doesn't.
And it's interesting because, yes, this is really kind of a dark, somber film at the core, but it's really playful. And you can tell his sense of humor. You know, he was in Monty Python for years and mm-hmm. years and years. He's actually the only non-British member of Monty Python.
Well,
was.
He is now fully British because he renounced his citizenship of America.
Yeah, but he became a dual citizen in 68. He became a British citizen. And then, yeah, it was when Bush was president. He was like, I'm done. And he denounced
it. Is he even thinking? Now he's like, oh, why did I do it so soon?
I know, I should have saved
really
it.
Done it for Trump.
So, no, but he was, yeah, the only non-British one. But his sense of humor is very clearly Monty Python.
Yeah.
And there's so many scenes in this film that we were just laughing out loud because they're just...
It's just a dark, lots and lots of dark
lots
humor.
Lots of dark humor. But also super relatable. There's...
Yeah.
The scene where all the workers are watching TV, like Casablanca or something like that, until the boss sticks his head out, Ian Holm,
mm-hmm.
and then they turn it off real quick, and he's like, did I imagine just hearing the TVs on? And so it's like every time the boss closes his door, they go back to watching TV so they don't have to work.
Have you ever had a job where you look busy for your boss?
100%.
Can you think of a good example?
Yeah, I will put like, or I had in the past, would have two screens open, one where I'm like watching or doing something and one with a work screen so that I could quickly minimize it. But I was really just like watching, you know, some program or something like that.
Oh, man.
So you're just forced to sit there for hours and hours a day and you got your work done. That's, I'm a strong believer in, you just come in, do what you need to do for the day and leave. You shouldn't have to just sit there for 8 hours. It's so boring.
When I worked at Hallmark, we had a horrible boss who would hire secret shoppers to come in and spy. And if we were standing behind the counter, we would get written up.
Really?
Oh, it was horrible. And so we were like, well, what are we supposed to do if no customers are in the store and we've done all of the cleaning things? And he said, then you need to organize cards. So
God, that's like Brazil to the T.
Oh, it was such a stupid thing. Even if we had already organized them, we were supposed to go organize them some more. So what we would do is one would stand on one side and the other on the opposite side so we could see eye to eye across. And we would give ourselves challenges like find the stupidest romance card. And so we'd spend time, it would look like we were busy, but we were just cracking ourselves up finding the cheesiest.
Smart.
Yeah, it was great to entertain ourselves, but
That's real smart. I at my last job, which I actually just finished yesterday, just left my job, but I didn't do it at that job. I was always busy, but jobs in the past I definitely would try and look busy because I knew I was supposed to be present in an office.
Somebody watching.
Yeah, I was just like, dude, I'm done anyway. So Brazil opens up And it opens in the clouds. And mm-hmm. we're not going to walk through this because it is 2.5 hours. I mean, it's a long movie, but we'll
there's so much attention to detail, too.
Touch on some cool scenes for sure. But I do like that it opens in the clouds. It's awesome. It's just a really cool
And it's opening. Hard to get your bearings, yeah. too. Like, where are you? You're flying through the clouds. It says 849, somewhere in the 20th century.
Yeah, and that title card with the neon Brazil when yeah. it comes up. Oh, it's just so, so beautiful.
And then it just leads us right into a storefront commercial on a TV, and it explodes.
Yeah.
So you're automatically kind of put off kilter because you can't set it in a reality that you understand. Mm-hmm. Like, immediately you go, well, where is this? What is the decade? What is what's happening? And it's very off-putting. And I think that's something that not enough directors do, because it leaves you as a viewer scrambling to get a toehold to understand what's happening, where you are at, and where the story is going to go.
Yeah, I do like that this film, from the moment it starts to the moment it ends, makes you have to work for it. You mm-hmm. have to think this whole entire film. And it's not like just put it on and tune out. You have to actually pay attention. Usually you have to stop. It really helped having somebody next to me and be like, wait, so what's going on? And we'd kind of hash it out on the spot mm-hmm. because it's not entirely clear. It's kind of like a Cronenberg film in that way, where when you watch it, you're like, I think I know what's going on. Some of it's a little over my head. And then when you finish the film, you go back and it starts to all make sense.
You're yeah.
like, okay.
Yeah. I think once you get all the way through, you go, okay, that's what happened. But as you're watching it, you go, wait, is this an important piece of information right. or not?
Yeah, but it is Christmas time. We do see a family sitting around an apartment building celebrating Christmas. So that's why we're covering this.
Yeah.
There, we checked that box.
Yep. So obviously it's Christmas. Oh, and I should mention, too, that exploding commercial, they're talking about duct work on the commercial.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And the reason that's interesting is because the whole movie is filled with insane ductwork.
It is.
So it's set, it feels kind of like it's in the future, but it also looks sort of like the technology of, like, I don't know, maybe 1920s to 1940s.
It's a weird mix, but I will say the technology in this film is so much fun. Like, the gadgets and the gizmos are cool. And there's several times when I was like, wait, we're kind of doing that now. Mm-hmm. Like, there were these little TVs that they're watching, and they look like watching movies on our cell phone.
Yeah.
Like, they look just like it, but this was so, so far ahead of the time. So it's always fun when that happens, when you watch a movie that takes place in the future, and the yeah. technology kind of lines up mm-hmm. pretty similar to what we have today.
I actually read an interview with Gilliam, and he said that he often gets credited with, like, being visionary about it. And he said people just don't realize that that's how things were then already. Like, all of the things that were happening in this were already happening in the 80s. He wasn't predicting the future. It just, nobody was tuned into it. And now we look back and we're like, whoa, it's brilliant. But he's like, I was just doing what was already there.
That's interesting, because we were talking about that with our episode on Videodrome with Cronenberg, we were like, oh, this is super contemporary right now, but yet he was just reflecting the time in the 80s.
Absolutely. I think it goes to show, just like with the other one, that we are not that complicated. We just kind of hash out the same problems over and over.
Kind of in a cycle.
Okay, so back to, there's a house, there's a family, they're watching TV, and this is a really important moment in the film, because basically everything spins out of control from here. So there's a woman upstairs. She's like smoking a cigarette in a dirty bathtub, watching TV. Below her is a family. It kind of goes back and forth between several things. First, there's a man in a different scene, totally separated. He's in his office and he is filling out some paperwork, which we later learn is for an arrest. But he's like trying to kill a bug, and the dead bug falls into the printer and turns a T into a B, mm-hmm. a Tuttle into a Buttle.
Right.
So keeping that in mind, then there is an invasion of this home of the family who's been watching TV by men who are like in black, and they have something like gas mask almost.
It's like a SWAT team.
They break in and they take a man named Mr. Buttle, So they take this man because of the mistake earlier from the T to a B and arrest him. They give his wife a receipt to the Ministry of Info and Records and basically are like, we've arrested your husband. Here's a receipt. Bye. But they do crazy stuff like take out a whole circle of flooring. They just, it's super unclear.
It's, you know what I do like though about this scene is it's very jarring and it's fast and it's kind of like scary in a way. And it sets up the tone immediately for what kind of world we're living in, where people can just come because they have a document. It gives them the right to do anything and everything, even if that document is totally wrong.
And that the people accept it. The wife just receives her receipt.
Yeah.
And is like, oh, okay.
So then let's flash to kind of the first real daydream. Mm-hmm. We'll get this throughout the whole entire film.
Just flashes of daydreams.
Right. But our main character, Mr. Lowry, is
Sam Lowry.
Yeah. Who's played by Jonathan Pryce. Fantastic performance.
Yeah. I read that this was like the pinnacle of his career in his own opinion.
Yeah, when I would think so. He gives it his all and he's like perfect.
He does a great job. Yeah.
But he has these daydreams where he's kind of in this knight's armor with these wings flying through the sky. And
He's like an archangel.
Yeah, and he keeps chasing like the woman of his dreams.
He has to rescue her.
Yeah. Is this so Dogma to you?
Yes.
Kevin Smith's Dogma.
Uh-huh. So,
but I do like that throughout, originally the intent was to just have the whole entire dream sequence right in the middle of the film, not divvied up.
Oh.
Yeah, and it got too complicated. And I actually think, like, I couldn't imagine it that way.
I can see it.
I liked it, how it kept spreading throughout, because it kept him kind of pushing forward.
It does keep the storyline more cohesive, I think. It would probably be a little bit confusing to just break into a dream sequence in the middle.
Yeah, but he wakes up, and it's like, we find out that he works in this, you know, typical office building, and he goes in, and we meet his mother. He's like from a very wealthy family, and his mom's constantly getting like plastic surgery. There's this whole subtext of other commentary on wealth and materialism that the mother represents too. I mean, there's a lot of subtext to this film.
It's so much. It's like impossible to really fully investigate in any podcast, or at least in one episode.
Although, did you see, speaking of technology, when he goes to dinner with his mom, the waiter brings the menus and he opens it up and they're full on iPads. They're just, they open up the menu and instead of it being a printed menu, it's a computer screen that you touch and it's got like boxes for all the menu items.
Interesting.
It's like, that's what we use now. It's so weird.
Yes. And they do order food. So he goes out to dinner with his mom and her friends, and the food they order, they have to say a number and they get their food, and their food is like a weird gelatinized puddle. But it's also got a photo of what it's supposed to be.
Right.
It's sort of sad and interesting. But he goes out to dinner with his mom. And basically, at this point, we get sort of a sense of this relationship. His mom wants him to move upward because he's just settled into mediocrity. He's happy enough at his job and doesn't want to move upward. But she has some pull and can get him a better job.
Yeah, and he has no desire to.
No, at least at this point, he is not interested in it. And she has a friend who's also getting facelifts.
Yeah.
That it pays. It's important because it comes in the end. But over the course of this whole movie, his mother's friend just keeps progressively getting weirder looking. She's got more bandages and stuff as her one facelift problem leads to another.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although his mother also continues to get facelifts throughout the whole movie, but she has better results.
Isn't there a scene, like a line, I can't remember correctly, where they, like one of them says, I have a problem with the problem I had or something like that. Like, they're basically trying to fix a problem for the other problem.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
I can't remember what it was, but it was pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
After the whole dinner scene, he's back in his apartment and he wakes up to this masked man who comes into his apartment. This is where we should probably get to because this is an important figure that plays into the rest of the film. This masked man, we find out, is this like renegade heating specialist named Harry Tuttle.
Yes, and he's a renegade because he just wants to fix heating and cooling problems without paperwork.
Yeah, because this will come into play when the actual people come over to fix the heating, and they're missing a document or something, and they freak out because they can't get anything done without this one piece of paper. And so this represents, you know, him just coming in and doing it, but he's a renegade, and that's why he was the one that they had the arrest warrant out for.
Yeah, not Mr. Buttle, who had nothing to do with anything.
No, it was Harry Tuttle, but that bug fell and changed the T to a B, and that's why that guy got arrested.
Also, the woman who had been in the bathtub above Mr. Buttle, Sam Lowry sees her on a screen when he is going to work the next day. And this is important because this is the first time he realizes that it's the woman who she at least resembles the woman who about whom he has been daydreaming.
Right. Yeah.
And so he sees her on his computer screen, and she's there to report the wrongful arrest of Mr. Buttle. And she's frustrated because she comes in with the paperwork all filled out. But they're like, no, 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 no. You need to get this, that, and the other. And she's like, ah!
Which is the most relatable scene in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, dude, I'm going to flip out on you.
Yes,
you
exactly.
Ask me to go get another piece of paper to submit this piece of paper.
And he sees her, but he can't find her. But he's immediately like, I need to discover who this woman is, this woman about whom I keep dreaming.
Right. Let's jump back to Tuttle.
Okay.
So why I wanted to bring him up is not only because he's the one that the arrest warrant was out for, but it's played by Robert De Niro, who was their big name. And there's an interesting backstory on De Niro's involvement in this. I don't know if you know the
story. I did, but please tell me.
Okay. Well, one of the producers was friends with De Niro. And Robert De Niro was also a huge Monty Python fan. So he wanted to be in this film really bad. But he was a big-time star, so they had to pay to get him in. This is nuts.
I didn't know that part.
Yeah. It was a total, this whole film took 22 weeks to shoot. De Niro was on set for 2 weeks, and they paid him $660,000.
In the 80s, that's $9 million today.
For 2 weeks, three times the amount Jonathan Pryce got paid for the lead role.
What?
I know. Isn't that just shocking? Especially because of what an amazing job he did. And then on top of that, it's well documented that De Niro was... he's a nice enough guy, but he was a bit difficult because most people would get their scenes done in a few takes. And he would kind of demand like 30 takes plus.
Oh.
Which is crazy because when you watch the final performance... He's not really doing a whole lot to need that many takes.
Well, I also heard, because I didn't hear that part, but I heard he wanted the part of the doctor.
Right. A Jack?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. He didn't get the part he wanted, so he was going to make the most of it.
No. He did a great job, though. He is a really great addition.
I agree.
Fantastic part. He did a good job, and I'm glad he was in it. But yeah, it was a little difficult for everybody involved because he's a big-time star.
Okay, so he comes in and he fixes, just sort of randomly, I think, Mr. Lowry's AC. And while he's doing that, the guys from Central, whatever, Intelligence or Heating and Cooling or whatever, come, say they're going to fix it, run off. Because Sam is like, you don't have the right paperwork, but he's really protecting Tuttle so that these two guys who are working for the government... don't see him there fixing it. So they run off. He fixes it, and then he jumps out of the...
I love this.
He like goes on the back patio, and then he has like a zip line into oblivion.
Which is cool because it's all miniature sets, and he's like little... Yeah, oh yeah, it's all like miniatures, and he's on a little zip line miniature, but it looks so incredibly cool. The way this film weaves... miniature set design with actual sets is so much fun because you're not quite sure what's happening when it's happening. And it just creates this world that you have to just accept from day one. But yeah, it's interesting because we've met this character now. So kind of everything's kind of being set for the most part.
He's figuring out what's happening because the very next day he goes to work and he's called into his boss's office. And he discovers that he has a check for Mrs. Buttle because Mr. Buttle has died while in custody. He had a heart condition.
Right.
And they didn't know about this heart condition because they had Tuttle's paperwork, not Buttle's.
Right.
So he died while in custody.
And you get this classic Ian Holm, who's, you know, Lord of the Rings fame.
Yeah, it's Bilbo.
He is the boss of Sam.
Yes.
And I love him because he's this kind of incompetent, like, can't really make any decisions on his own and keeps having Sam kind of step up and make the decisions for him.
Yep.
And he's like, we need to get this check to the widow. And Sam volunteers and he says, you know what, I'll just take care of it.
More than that, though, he's trying to make sure that blame doesn't fall on his department for this error.
Yes.
So nobody cares that Mr. Buttle has died because of a mistake. Not one person is upset about it besides Mrs. Buttle and Jill, the upstairs neighbor. Everybody else is concerned with passing the buck off to whoever gets the blame for this accidental death.
And is this the part when we meet his friend Jack, the doctor, and we discover how he died? Because he goes to meet his friend,
yeah,
who's the interrogator, basically, and mm-hmm. says, like, oh, he had a heart attack. We didn't know he had a heart problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's really... It's interesting because he's so dismissive of it. This is a more commentary on the way it's handled, because he's like, hey, it was a mistake. It was a paperwork mistake. How was I supposed to know? Everybody in this film is constantly trying to kind of wipe their hands clean.
So nobody is at fault.
Nobody's at fault ever, which is like classic.
Yes, it's fantastic. But Sam, in an effort to just get Mrs. Buttle to sign the check, drives to her house and he tries to ask directions from kids out front. And there are kids holding up another kid at gunpoint. It's like just a brief scene, but he just like kind of interrupts this holdup to ask for directions. And they just basically tell him to bugger off. And then he finds himself to the Buttle house, but nobody answers the door. He lets himself in through the door that is still broken. Like nobody came to fix it after Mr. Buttle was taken. It's just totally trashed. But Mrs. Buttle is there and she says, my husband is dead. She knows. And she tears up the receipt, the check, all of it. She just is out of control.
This is a really like tough scene to watch.
It's so human in the midst of this machine.
She screams it.
Yeah.
She screams this scene and it's really tragic because she screams, what have you done with his body?
Yeah.
And what's crazy is that Sam up to this point is kind of, we're led to believe he's the only one that's kind of seeing this all for the nonsense that it is. But he's full on engaging in it right here, yeah, where he's like, look, you know, we make mistakes. Can you just sign this paper? Because that would make things a lot easier. And it's weird because you immediately see he's still kind of part of the problem. Yeah. Even though he's reacting against it.
He's not empathizing with her at all. He's not saying, I'm sorry your husband died. He's really concerned with getting that check signed.
And it's taken on the approach of his doctor friend Jack, where he's like, look, I'm just doing my job. Mm-hmm. You know, what can you do? Speaking of Jack, did you recognize him at all? Maybe not.
Oh, is he from Monty Python?
Yeah, he's Sir Galahad the Pure.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you remember what Terry plays?
No.
In the Holy Grail?
No.
He plays Patsy, the assistant with the coconuts.
That's right. So, okay, anyway, she tears up the receipts and or check or whatever and screams. And then her children attack. But at this point, Sam sees his dream woman, whose name is Jill, peering at him through the hole in the floor that the people who came to take Mr. Buttle had made.
Right.
And so he is racing to find her, but she escapes outside. He runs after and finds his car has been blown up. And throughout this whole movie, there's just kind of bombs going off constantly.
And it's interesting because I read up on that and Terry was living during the time he was over in Europe during the time of the bombings in Ireland and stuff like that.
I figured.
So he's feeling very affected by that. The cars, too, we should talk about, are really cool. These like little tiny sardine can futuristic looking cars.
It's weird because they're both futuristic and a throwback.
Yeah.
So it's like the tiny zippy cars that you see for like the smart cars and stuff that people have now, but like 1940s versions.
This whole film is like that, yes. though. It's like a futuristic film in the 40s.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre and kind of fascinating.
So he goes back to his work and learns that his boss actually secretly turned down a promotion for him, which is a big bummer because he realizes that this promotion his mother had arranged that he didn't initially want, he does now want to accept because it will give him access to private information so he can track down this Jill woman.
Right, because he'll be working for the, what's the name of the department? The information...
Department of Information.
Department of Information, yeah. Or something like that. So now he can basically hack into the system and track down her info. And he's becoming all consumed at this point in the film with just finding this dream woman.
Yeah, and it's another another note, too. His boss is like, oh, I just turned down your promotion by signing it. So his boss just forged his signature to keep him in his position.
Right, but he does end up taking the position.
Yes.
He gets an office. This whole scene's really fun. I mean, we're really flying through this film right now, but... It's yes. funny because this is an important scene where he gets his own badge and his very own office. And it's just so much, again, additional commentary on congrats. You now have the big job and you're working for the man. And he goes in and it's basically like a utility closet. And there's this great humor, very dark humor, where the desk that he uses is actually split through the wall with the desk on the other side in the other office by another person.
Yes.
And they keep pulling it back and forth so they can have more of the desk in their office.
A little bit more of their half.
It's all very lighthearted, but at the same time, it's like really accurate.
And so frustrating.
Yeah.
And so relatable for anybody who has worked any menial job.
Yes.
At any point.
But he has the position now, and he immediately, he wastes zero time.
Oh, information retrieval, I think.
Yeah, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Yep. He wastes zero time trying to like hack the system to get in there and figure out where she is, where she lives, all that kind of stuff, so he can find her. It also breaks into another daydream scene around here.
He just keeps having daydreams between, like, almost every real-life scene. There's a daydream of him. Now he's battling, like, a samurai-type guy.
Yeah, the samurai starts to appear. That starts to become a recurring theme. But this one that I like, and this one in particular, is she's in a cage, and he's looking up at her, and he's trying to get to her, and this rock monster comes out.
It's Brick. Like cobblestone.
Oh, right. Yeah, it reaches up and forms this creature, almost like Neverending Story style.
Yeah, like Rockbiter.
Yeah, it's really awesome. I mean, just there's so many cool parts of this
film. It grabs
him
and asks him not to go, which is so interesting to me.
We get a bunch more future technology, which is super cool, but then eventually he finds Jill.
But this is also where we learn that Jack, the doctor, is not so good.
No, he's kind of really weird and disturbing.
It's very interesting. And did you read about this scene?
No.
What's his name who played him? Do you remember his name?
Michael Palin?
Yes. Yeah. So he apparently had filmed this scene and he was a little unsettled by it. Like, he just didn't quite get it right. And then Gilliam called him back later and said, I think we need to redo this. So he had his own daughter, Gilliam's daughter, plays Jack's daughter in this scene.
Oh, that's who's sitting on the floor?
Yeah.
Oh.
And so Pelin said that having this little kid there, while he's talking about all these dark subjects, about like just nonchalantly killing a person and not really caring, while creating this family dynamic, was sort of like where the money was with this particular scene.
Oh, weird.
Because you get this dichotomy and also this disassociation between work and family life. Like, I was just doing my job. I'm focused on my child here. But he's holding his child, like, touching her and being fatherly towards her while talking about taking another person's life very nonchalantly.
It's really weird.
And his coat's covered in blood, too. Back to Jack and Sam's conversation. Jack is ready to deal with Jill because he knows she's a witness to their mistake. So basically, they just want to take out Jill because she's the only one who knows about the mistake at this point. They've effectively covered up the error from the bug falling on the BT mistake.
Don't they also think she's a terrorist?
Well,
or do they just peg her as a terrorist to kind of justify getting her?
Yeah. So he wants to deal with her, but Sam is like, I'll deal with her. I'll deal with her. And he gets the information and he's going to go hunt her down. So on his way down the elevator, he sees Jill, but it's like a funny scene. So he's left Jack's office. He's in this glass elevator and he can see her in the front lobby. But all this technology is malfunctioning, and the technology malfunctions almost 100% this whole movie. It's people just dealing with a stupid technology failing. He sees her, and he's like, oh my goodness, and he's like pushing buttons on the elevator, but he can't get to her, and it puts him in the basement. And so it's just like this whole nonsense of a person just trying to get from point A to point B, but there's so many obstacles, and it's usually human-created obstacles.
It's really funny because this constant thread from multiple avenues throughout this film is like, humans are just trying to live their life, but technology's getting in the way, paperwork's getting in the way.
And it's like, all constructs that they've brought
something.
In.
Yeah, it's always something that they created to make their life easier or more efficient that ends up ultimately being more of a problem.
So he ends up on the wrong floor, and they're trying to arrest him or shoot him because he doesn't have an ID, and he, like, bolts for it. And he makes it back to that main floor. And they now have Jill at gunpoint because they think she's a terrorist. But he does some quick thinking, basically, and rescues her.
Well, he's got the badge, and that, like, puts him in charge.
So he and Jill escape, but he also has a hold of her file, which he had gotten from Jack. And Jack had been like, don't lose it. And they get outside of the building, and it's this really frustrating. Maybe you didn't find it frustrating, but I did. He has this file, and he keeps losing papers.
Oh, yeah.
As he's focused his energy elsewhere, and papers keep flying. And I'm like, dude, your paperwork. Just get your papers.
This whole film, there are papers constantly just flying around.
Yes.
It's really funny.
And they're all representative of mistakes made by others,
right?
At least in my mind. So
well, and that they're going to be misfiled when they go back, and it's going to have a profound impact on somebody's life.
Exactly,
but it won't be their life; it'll be somebody else's. So, what do they care?
Yeah, and they'll all just cover it up and keep on going.
Speaking of papers, in a way, and tape.
Mm-hmm.
When they went outside, do you remember that dog that walked by?
Yeah,
it had its butthole taped.
Yeah, what's the story there?
No,
you didn't. Is it taped or is it,
it had
like
a little X of tape over its butt?
Was it actual tape or was it like a little cartoon X out of the dog's butthole?
I don't know. I don't know what that was about.
Just it was so tiny and you could miss it—not the butthole, but just like a tiny scene. And that was that. Yeah. No explanation.
Well, he hops in her vehicle because she drives this big old, like...
She's like a delivery person.
Yeah, delivery truck. And he hops in and wastes no time confessing his love. He's like, you're the girl of my dreams and I love you. And she's like, okay.
She doesn't trust him. She thinks he's a spy or whatever.
No, and she ends up kicking him out of the truck.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this very humorous scene of him, like, not going away and, like, holding on as she's driving.
Hanging on the back and writing her notes and stuff.
Yeah, and he ultimately, he says, like, I love you on through the dirt on the windshield.
Uh-huh.
She thinks she runs him over, and then he peeks his head out. And somehow this has kind of charmed her because she realizes... This guy is really quirky, but not...
Yeah.
He's not dangerous. He's just weird. So she does let him back in. And
that's our love story.
Yeah, very similar. this is kind of how they develop their relationship. And I do like this, that it's building not like, hey, I love you, okay.
Yeah.
But it's more like they have to kind of get to... She has to get to know him, and I like that.
And while their relationship does develop, he's obsessed with her, and... Her interest, I don't think, ever gets to the same level as his.
It's more opportunistic. Like she's like, sure, okay.
So eventually she lets him back in, and he basically accompanies her on her job. She picks up a package, and he's actually terrible in these scenes with her.
Yeah, he's really pushy.
He forces her to run a roadblock, and they go to a department store where she's going to deliver this, but he keeps insinuating that she's the bomber, which is a weird thing to do if you're trying to profess your love to a person. Yeah. And while they're in this department store, there is another explosion. Both of them are okay. And also, you know, I kind of brushed past it, but when they were having, he was having dinner with his mom earlier, there was an explosion, and everybody just kind of carries on and ignores it while people are, like, toasted and burnt.
There's actually multiple explosion scenes, like public bombings, and they're kind of graphic. Like, they're really disturbing.
People just recovering.
And people just keep going about their business. This scene, though, in the mall, there's a mall Santa, so there's your Christmas tie-in. There is
Christmas.
Subtle Christmas sprinkling throughout this film to remind you. Yeah, there's also these really cool propaganda posters spread throughout, which I love. Those are really fun. I wanted to look at those a little bit closer.
But during this explosion, and this is the only time you see it, she tries to help people. She's like, it's like she dialed out of the Matrix and realizes what's happening. And so she tries to help these burned people instead of waiting for the authorities who come to explosions to deal with it. Whereas everybody else just kind of carries on, even though there's, like, bleeding people and burned people. And honestly, it feels so on the pulse of today.
Oh, like, yeah, for sure.
I mean, how many, like, shootings or bombings do we hear about every single day? And we're like, whoa, okay, anyway, I'm going to continue on.
It's interesting to think about how this plays out, too. I would see how in Europe this was maybe more effective than in America, because at this time...
Yes.
It was very few and far between that we had public bombings or public death like we do now, which is literally a weekly occurrence, you know, if not daily. So now it's very disturbing because it's something that we're living with. And that's another way in which this film has just stayed very relevant. Also, he accuses her, like you said, and she's really offended. She's like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to help these people. And you're sitting here saying, I'm the bomber?
And her package, while she was being coy about what was in the package, it's quite a leap to accuse somebody of bombing. But the package just had bras in it.
Yeah,
that's
that
all
was
she
funny.
Was delivering.
Yeah.
And then we go back to more daydreaming about fighting. And this is really interesting, too, because we see Sam failing at love. We see him failing at his job because he really screwed up his first day at the new job. We see him just failing all around. And so he retreats back into his dream world and he's like fighting the bad guy. And he pulls the mask finally off of this bad, like samurai looking guy. And who is it?
It's him.
It's himself. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really cool kind of surrealist scene.
For sure.
It's great. And then he goes back to his apartment and it's completely frozen over because those two numbskulls who were worried about the paperwork have like hijacked his apartment basically. And who knows what they're doing, but Tuttle pops back into the picture. We haven't seen him in a long time. And he does this weird thing where he pulls all this stuff out of the wall and switches like the sewage line with the air line. And their air is going into their suits. He switches it over, and then the sewage starts filling up their suits.
It's like they have hazmat suits or
so
something.
So disgusting.
Ugh.
So it's like poop suits, and then it explodes.
Poop suits.
And Sam finds that very amusing. And then he just zips on by, like just keeps going.
So after the liquid poop suit,
right.
Sam and Jill obviously can't stay in Sam's house. So they go to his mother's house. They're like looking for some shelter, like to hide out, essentially. And they end up at his mother's house because she's away for whatever reason. More plastic surgery, I think.
Yeah. Well, she's having tons of it. And that'll come into play at the end.
Yes. So they have an opportunity to hook up. They start kissing. And then Weird Sam, who seems to have been building up towards this, like everything he's wanted is coming true. He's getting with Jill. He instead runs off because he's going to save her.
Yeah, he's got a grand plan. He breaks into the boss's office and he's going to kill her through paperwork.
Yes, he's going to make her look dead on paperwork.
So that they'll leave her alone and they can be free to be with each other and she won't be in danger anymore. And he does. He pulls it off.
Although, I don't think Jill needed saving as much as he seemed to think she needed saving. Like, she seemed pretty okay until he started messing with her life.
Yeah. But, I don't know. He kills her off in paperwork. He comes back. He's so proud. And she says this really weird line where he says, "You're dead now." And she says, "Care for a little necrophilia?"
Oh, yeah, that was weird.
And then
weird.
They, like, make love. And it's really... I couldn't tell if this was a daydream or not, but it's not. Like,
no.
They're...
They finally...
Because she's wearing this wig where she looks like the character in his daydream. Did you catch all that?
Well, are you talking about when his mom shows up?
No.
Oh, okay.
So he comes back in and she's wearing this kind of like see-through white dress, but she's got like long blonde hair. She's got a wig on.
Well, this is where reality and fantasy begin to blend.
Yeah, it's really strange, but they do end up like finally getting together. And then, of course, like always, like, you know, the SWAT team crashes in.
Yes.
And they take him away.
They hook him up to a weird machine.
Yeah, they come and they're gonna pull him away because he's committed treason, basically, by abusing his power in his new position, and this is not good. And so they take him, and Jack, his friend, walks in. They've got him hooked up in this, like, torture room.
Yes.
And he's wearing this really creepy baby mask.
Why? Never explained? No reason?
I don't know. Yeah, it is very disturbing looking, though.
So Jack's there, and he's basically just trying to get information because that's Jack's job. He tortures the truth, air quotes, or out of people.
And it's important to note that when he was being taken away, he's asking where Jill is, and they're saying she was killed, like, in the shootout.
Yeah.
And that he's been captured. She's dead, he's captured, and he's now sitting in this chair about to be tortured, and he knows that it's Jack, his friend, even though he's wearing this baby mask.
So there's a shootout, and Sam escapes only to set off bombs at his place.
Yeah, because Tuttle leads this team to come rescue Sam and shoot Jack through the head
and
all that
kind of
stuff.
Yeah, it's like a big old shootout.
So it's like, okay, well, there's some justice, you know, everybody there.
The rebels are gathering.
Yeah, and he's getting out of there, and it's all going to be good.
And then we shoot to another scene at the funeral of his mother's friend, this woman who's been getting progressive... plastic surgery. She finally died. But his mother is on the opposite end of the spectrum, and she's had so much plastic surgery that she looks incredibly young and an awful lot like Jill.
Yeah, it kind of switches in and out. It's kind of like a weird Lynchian kind of thing where there's
Freudian and Lynchian.
It's very weird.
So many Ians.
So it's weird because, like, now his mom is becoming... Similar to Jill, he's actually become the terrorist that he was worried about the whole time.
Yeah.
He's blowing everything up. It's just gone. It's gone completely bonkers at the end.
And you can't really get a feel for what's real and what's fantasy at this point either.
Because he, like, stumbles through the coffin of the friend into this, like, street scene. It's just so weird.
So Sam ends up in custody. And Jill is driving outside. They seem to escape and find themselves in a beautiful valley.
Yes.
And so it would seem it's a happy ending. Like, he escapes. They've found their way to this beautiful paradise outside of the bureaucracy and chaos of the world in which they had lived.
Yes. And the original producers or
they
the distribution would have loved this ending.
Yes.
But here's where we get the very, very final scene, which is incredibly sad and tragic, is that whole entire escape and meeting up with Jill and everything else was all in his brain because he's basically been lobotomized and is sitting in that chair still being tortured.
In what looks like Magneto's chamber.
Totally, it does.
It does.
Yeah.
So it's revealed that he has been basically experimented on and Sam is gone. And that's kind of the end of the movie. They dealt with it. Although I did read that the place where they filmed this final scene is now an IKEA.
Oh, really?
Which is kind of poetry, isn't it?
There's one subtle scene that we didn't even discuss. That there's a lot of surrealism in this film, too.
Yes, for sure.
Tuttle, how he leaves, is after that he breaks them out and they're running through the city.
Mm-hmm.
This paperwork starts attaching to Tuttle. To the point of it, like, overwhelms him with paper.
Oh, right.
And then he just disappears into the paper.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these subtle scenes where I was like, is this in his mind? Is this fantasy?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell. And that's what I think made the ending so effective, was when it flashes from that extreme juxtaposition between the beautiful meadow with him and Jill to him with like a machine hooked up to his brain being tortured. It was really jarring. And then it just, that's the film. And wow, I mean, it's, this is pretty epic.
You know, I actually read a little bit about the ending. So I suspect that you see that as a pretty dark ending. And I don't see it as an especially dark ending for two reasons. One, because Sam's not really suffering at the end, is he? He seems pretty darn happy with the situation, even though he's been lobotomized, and from the outside we're like, ooh, that's too bad. But also there's like a sense of hope, like that maybe he'll get out, maybe he'll be saved. All of these things still linger at the end. It doesn't seem final. It doesn't seem conclusive. But I read Gilliam's writing on that, and he also considers himself an optimist, but he was talking about how he could see pessimists seeing this in such a dark way, in such a hopeless way.
Which is very much you and I, the optimist and the pessimist.
Yeah.
Because I see it as the love of his life, who he finally found, is dead, and he's hooked up to a machine being tortured. And it's very tragic because in the end, all of this was for nothing. Like, the man is still in charge and nothing's changed. And I think that's really tragic because there's no optimism to the idea of, if you just stand up and you do what's right, you can create change. Instead, it's you just get put in a room and tortured.
But is it, first of all, is it torture if you don't recognize that you're being tortured?
I don't know, but I'll tell you that he was having a pretty bad trip. I don't know if he was really enjoying himself.
Oh, at the end, he's happy, and he starts, we should also say, he starts singing the Aquarello do Brasil.
Yeah.
This beautiful song. And that's how it ends, with him singing that.
Which I read, and I don't know if this is true or not, but the way he got the name of this film and the premise was that he was on a beach, Terry was on a beach, and saw somebody listening to this, looking out onto the beach, and this was like, he wrote the ending first.
I see that for sure.
And then he wrote, how would it get to this point, basically. I think that's really fascinating, which it totally explains why he fought for this ending to stay intact.
Yeah, if that's your starting
you
point.
You built the whole film around this damn ending.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I don't see it as an incredibly dark ending at all. I do see it as hopeful, and I don't feel like all... I feel like this movie ends in sort of a midpoint.
Yeah.
Like, where you could see a sequel coming from it, or people... Not like I want to see a sequel to Brazil, but... The idea is that it's, you've watched the first chapter in a long story, and it feels so open, not conclusive.
It feels like a novel. It definitely feels like a book, and it's really interesting because it's just so vast and broad in the world that was created. What are your thoughts overall on this film, especially after not seeing it for so many years?
Right. Well, I loved it. I think I appreciated it more this time than any other viewing.
Yeah, I would agree.
Probably because I had to really take it all in a way that I hadn't previously had to understand it. And I also did outside research to help me, I don't know, wrap my mind around what Gilliam was trying to accomplish here instead of just imagining that I understood it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really loved it a great deal. I don't know, as an artist and a kind of daydreamer myself, I related so hard to it. I thought it was beautiful and sad, but also hopeful. What about you?
I think going back to what we started with, saying that it was a little too over our head when we first saw it as teenagers.
Well, sure.
Is anybody who, you know, like ourselves that write stories or make films... When I was younger, I just accepted this as like, okay, cool film. But as somebody who's actively making art in that way, I'm like, damn, how did you pull this off? Because I think once you've written a film script or you've worked on a movie or written a book or anything, you have such a deeper appreciation for when you see something that is this well thought out, this well done, you know, this satirical kind of view of paperwork and jobs and daydreams and all this kind of materialism and violence. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's so well conceived and so perfectly executed that it makes you want to be a better artist. These are kind of the standards that you set yourself up for as you say, okay, look, like, there's a film and then there's Brazil. And whether it's your cup of tea or not, you can't deny that the endeavor to pull this off is just amazing. And it perfectly makes sense why it's on so many lists of considered, I mean, in England, it's considered one of the greatest British films ever made.
Yeah.
Right place, right time, perfect writing, great cast, amazing set design. Everything just came together in this to make, to completely justify why this is given the appreciation it is, which is fascinating because it flopped when it came out. It was not a success at all. It became a cult film that picked up over the years.
Yeah, it gained momentum.
And everybody sat around going, wait, this film is brilliant.
Yeah, well, I could see that, though, because if you just went to go see a movie on a weekend, this is
this is not your movie.
This is not what you need to see. This isn't really a movie to see in a theater, honestly.
No.
I mean, maybe in like a cool art house theater, but most people who go to see the movies aren't going to see this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
This is something you watch and you consider.
If you have not seen this, do yourself a favor and see it, because this is really well done. If you have seen it but haven't seen it in a long time, maybe revisit it. It's just rare that a film like this comes along.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a special one.
Yeah, it's a good one to revisit every decade or so and look at it with fresh eyes.
And it did take place on Christmas.
Oh, yeah. There was Santa Claus, for sure. They mentioned Christmas at least three separate times.
We're coming back next week with another holiday episode, so stick with us.
And you can see that we're playing fast and loose with the term holiday.
Yeah, we are. Ernest Saves Christmas.
No.
Okay, well, if you like what you heard, the best thing you can do is rate, review.
Yes,
anywhere you get a podcast, check us out, download that stuff, tell a friend. You can find us on Instagram at Laser Graves. Our personal sites are on Instagram. I'm at Death at 33 RPM.
I'm at Mariah Rose Wimmer.
And we really appreciate you listening. All the new listeners that we've been getting.
Yeah, which thanks, guys.
Finally, it's been building. It's good. It's feeling good. Stick with us and tell some friends, and we'll bring something new for you next week.
Thanks.
Bye.